Whether you want to escape the snow or plan it, Arias Medical has you covered. Try a rewarding travel assignment during the holiday season with Arias Medical Group. Call Arias at 1-800-340-2619 or visit ariusmedical.com. That's AUREUS medical.com.
This is the PT Pintcast, a podcast that talks about physical therapy over beer, bringing together clinicians, researchers, and forward-thinking PTs in a show that's anything but boring.
Let there be beer!
This is the PT Pintcast with your host, Jimmy McKay.
All right, our next guest is the founder and CEO of Evidence in Motion and partner in Confluent Health, which includes EIM, a network of 80-plus physical therapy clinics, and Fit for Work, which helps employers decrease injuries and workers' compensation costs. A graduate from the U.S. Air Force Academy, he completed an MBA from the University of Arizona and a PhD in Rehabilitation Sciences from the University of Pittsburgh. Having served 20 years in the Air Force, he has collaborated on more than 10 million dollars in grant funding and published more than 150 scientific papers, and is a fellow podcaster hosting the Evidence in Motion podcast that you can find now on iTunes. Welcome to the PT Pintcast, John Childs. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jimmy. Really appreciate you having me.
Yeah, we ran into each other at Graham sessions.
We did.
We can't talk about who said what there. I know that's the rule. We've learned that. But really heard what everybody was saying in the room. I've been following you online and what EIM is and does, and what you kind of talk about through your social media outlets. So I want to make sure people know how to find you at ChildsJD on Twitter. And I think that's a great place for conversations. I've said it before on this show. Quick conversations, asking questions, and getting down different rabbit holes that you never thought you would have been. That's possible on Twitter. So I like that. So that's ChildsJD and evidenceinmotion.com. I've heard of Evidence in Motion since I was a student. I've just seen a logo everywhere. What do you describe Evidence in Motion as? What is it?
It's a great question, Jimmy. And first off, just we have grown. But first of all, just really shout out to you, Jimmy, just for what you've done in the podcast world, I must say. As a sort of disclaimer, you sort of inspired us, actually. We've been talking about podcasting at EIM for some time, and here comes this upstart student with a PT Pintcast that's got lots of followers and growing. Obviously, on the EIM side, we train lots of physical therapists around the country and internationally as well. The student population is a big audience for us, certainly. So when I first started listening to your podcast, I became an avid follower.
Cool.
And just want to say
you.
Thanks for all you do. On the EIM side, we started in earnest about 10 years ago. I was a PhD student at the University of Pittsburgh, had just a world-class research experience, great mentors like Tony DeLito and Julie Fritz, and just
names.
Really big, big opportunity, publishing a lot of high-quality trials, grant funding, but really becoming sort of frustrated at the academic, ivory tower of just sort of beating clinicians over the head of, how to do sort of best practice.
Kind of like two different towers. Like, well, we put rubber to road, we're clinicians, but we want to make sure we have the best evidence-informed information. How do we get one to get to the other?
Yeah, that's right. In Pittsburgh at the time, you got to put it in context. So this is the early 2000s. Evidence-based practice was just becoming sort of in vogue. It was a brand new term. And Pittsburgh was way ahead of the curve and really wanting to be relevant to clinical practice. And so as a PhD student there, you were never far removed from the clinic at all, because the idea is practically applied. Let's really develop knowledge that's going to inform clinical practice. And so EIM was really born out of my experience in Pittsburgh, wanting to come alongside clinicians and really partner with them in helping them translate best evidence into practice. So around 2004, 2005, that's when I bumped into Larry Benz, who's one of our partners. He had a group of clinics in Kentucky at the time. We had this wild, harebrained idea of developing kind of evidence-based practice guidelines and some courses, starting to think about doing...
Because now it's a thing. What are we going to do with it? How are we going to spread this? How are we disseminate this information to everybody?
Yeah, exactly. And in the early 2000s, online education was like, people didn't have any idea what that sort of was. Larry was actually one of our first customers in Kentucky, and so we experimented with some of these ideas in their clinics. It worked. It was really having an influence in how clinicians were practicing. The problem of continuing education in its classic form, you go to a weekend course and you show up Monday morning and nothing changes at all about your practice.
Right.
Now, what we know about changing practice behaviors, you've really got to have larger doses of education.
Much like physical therapy.
Much like physical therapy. So you go to PT school for 3 years, you're obviously fundamentally radically changed in terms of how you practice. The problem is 10, 15 years from now, Jimmy, unless you continue to really dive deeply,
atrophy.
You're going to be practicing 20 years from now just like you do right now. And so EIM really was born out of this idea to build lifelong learning strategies for therapists, you know, all over the country. And so we've put together a number of certification programs, residency programs, and fellowship programs.
It's a lot. Delivered. Even just to say, that's a lot.
Well, it's, you know, it's obviously been a development over the last number of years, and doing it in a blended learning model. So the beauty of most of our programs is that therapists can work full-time and go through our content online. We do both live sessions, synchronous, asynchronous, and then they come together on the weekends for the hands-on psychomotor courses.
That's cool. It's amazing to me you brought up evidence-based practice coming around the early 2000s. I mean, I went to start a PT school in 2013, and it's just always been. You know what I mean? Like, I've never not known that. So the fact that it wasn't a thing, like, just confuses me. I'm like, what do you mean? You know, it's like with kids today are like, what do you mean there's life before cell phones? You're like, oh, let me gather around the fire, kids. Let me tell you about what we had to do. We had to make plans and stick to them. But it's amazing to me where this thing that we just know and we stick to now as a field just wasn't really a thing then.
Yeah.
So good on you for spotting that and saying this is going to go and we got to stick to this, especially if we want to be recognized as what we want to be, which is an effective field in the healthcare system. That's why you started. That's where it is now. Where's EIM going to go? But this is a lot like the Graham Sessions thing that we had hosted and we shared, which is where was it? Where is it now? And then where's it going to go? Where's specifically Con Ed? And then I want to get to DPT education too. Where's Con Ed going to go? Because it wasn't anywhere in early 2000s, but it's everywhere now.
Yeah, you bet. So over the last 10 years, most of what we've been up to on the EIM side is all post-professional, post-graduate training, so working with licensed therapists. In about 2011, 2012, we started to really get interested in taking some of what we had learned in how to do blended learning in the postgraduate environment, moving it upstream into entry-level DPT. And we could spend an entire hour on sort of the, you know, bully pulpit of DPT education. But suffice it to say that in the, you know, early 2000s, as the profession shifted from the master's to the doctor degree, the profession invested a lot of energy into upgrading the didactic curriculum. You know, we added pharmacology, radiology, imaging. But really, clinical education had not been touched
in
like 50 years. It didn't change at all with the DPT. We still send students out in this very haphazard one-on-one model, and I'll put my academic hat on and say that we basically hope and pray that when students go to a clinic that they learn something. But we don't really know for sure, and there's no standardization, there's no curriculum. So we got interested on the EIM side in partnering with academic institutions to help elevate and standardize clinical education. So we built a clinical education curriculum. And we opened up our network of practices, because we've got a lot of practices
80 plus.
Ourselves.
Yeah.
But we also work with a lot of the real high-quality employers around the country who utilize our programs as a way to recruit and retain therapists.
So now you know how they're learning, because they're using your continuing education courses as clinics. Now you know, well, they're probably a good site to send students.
That's right. And we've got a 10-year history, right, of training therapists in residency and fellowship programs. So we have a lot of very high-quality clinical educators that are ready and willing and wanting to take students. So let's develop this network of clinics where we've got some predictability around the level of training that these therapists have. We've got a curriculum. Let's open it up and sort of build it, and they will come. Well, the problem is DPT programs are entrenched in the status quo.
Right.
And the reality is they didn't come. I mean, we literally said, here's a bunch of sites. You're welcome to send students. It's free. Doesn't cost you anything. And they're like, thanks, but no thanks. We have our
our contracts locked up. In the
way of kind of doing things. And the problem was, you know, clinical education is very short. You tend to do these, you know, 3 to 4, 8 week at a time rotations.
Right.
And the one stipulation we had is fundamentally we think clinical education needs to be done in longer blocks of time.
How much?
So we said minimum of 6 months. And that was really part of the problem, is that the curricula in a lot of programs
didn't
was not
fit.
Built for that. So what we learned from that really failure was that if we really want to influence entry-level DPT, we're frankly going to have to be on the very, very front side from the very beginning to the very end. And actually, I don't want to say control the whole process, but we're going to have to build a curriculum from the ground up.
That's going to fit your vision.
Exactly. And so we had a couple of options. One was we could become a university and actually go to CAPTI as EIM and
start
launch.
School.
But that's a 10-year, $10 million proposition to become a regionally accredited degree-granting university. And so we thought, you know, if we want to get this done in our lifetime, we should partner with existing programs that want to start a PT program, but may not have all of the resources to do it. Because if you want to start a PT program, it's very difficult to recruit faculty. It's extremely difficult to identify clinical sites. Well, that just so happens to be one of our two of our biggest assets on the IM side. So we can come alongside the institutions to help them do that. And so we explored a number of options. You know, our model was a two-year accelerated blended model DPT. We started saying things like students can live anywhere in the country. We were going to and have built this what we call immersion labs where students commute into the campus for 10 to 12 days at a time. So you might imagine this is a fairly controversial
idea. Well, when you
say
2 years and you can live anywhere you want, I'm sure everybody's going, huh?
Yeah, so
you can't do that anywhere.
Yeah,
you can't do that anywhere.
It really raises the hair on the neck of a lot of folks in academics. And folks said, no, you can't do this. CAPTI will never approve this. It's never going to happen. And I'll never forget, and I can share this because I was the one who said this at the Graham Sessions back in probably 2013. I first got up in front of the Graham Sessions to sort of proffer this idea. This was a harebrained kind of crazy idea.
Best ideas ever.
And an individual that I won't name since it's the Graham Sessions, but who's very influential from an accreditation perspective, stood up and she was the first one that came to the mic and I almost started breaking out into a sweat because I thought I was about to hear all the reasons why this idea would never get off the ground.
Right.
What I heard was something very different. Now, this individual did not endorse what we were doing, but she made it very clear that nothing that I had articulated ran afoul of any of the evaluative criteria. Hmm. Not the length, not the 2 years, not the fact that we would have faculty living all over the country, students coming from all over the country, blended model. And so that was really, at least for me, not an endorsement, but we knew that we were operating within the confines of what our accreditation
allows. It was a crazy idea, but it wasn't impossible. Now.
Exactly. And that's how we bumped into South College, which was our first partner that we worked with. And so we started developing this first model with them back in 2013-14, and we're fortunate to navigate our way through the the CAPTI process to get candidacy. We started our first class of 65 students in 2015. Started another group of almost 100 students in 16. So I'm happy to say we're coming up on the graduation of our first class actually this summer.
That's got to be pretty exciting. Kudos to you. That's really, really cool. I mean, you saw a giant problem. You did what we all do, which is, you know, well, I would do this, I would do this. But you did what few people do, which is now I'm going to go do it.
It's funny you say that because some people, I widely talk about this model and kind of what we're up to in academics. And, you know, people say, why do you so widely share your sort of secret sauce ideas of what you're doing? And I don't say this as a compliment, I guess, but, you know, a lot of folks in academics are slow to change. So, frankly, there's enough resistance out there that there's really a lot of watchful waiting to see what we're doing, whether it's going to be successful or not.
Plus, what you're doing, I mean, you're being very open. Here's what we're going to do. Here's what exists. 3 years, and you have to live here. You know, all the things that exist. We're going to change it here. Here's how. And if you want to know, I mean, it's a very open process. I mean, just easily to explain.
No, that's exactly right. And part of the reason we were so transparent and open is because, frankly, the criticism, even from some of our most vocal opponents, has really informed the development of our program. And so we've learned, even from our critics, and that's been a real beneficial part, is to hear from the academic community on what their perceptions are of what's working and what's not working. And so, you know, we'll see when our first students sit for the licensure exam in July.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to get more into this and more into the entrepreneur side of things, because you're a little bit of a hybrid. I mean, I'd say a lot of a hybrid, a lot of different things coming together, which kind of makes EIM kind of great and kind of work. So we'll get back to that up next in the PT Podcast. Don't move.
Taking IPAs over TKAs. It's the PT Pinecast.
Do you treat patients with chronic pain, recurring sports injuries, or posture issues? Then check out Rock Tape, the world's best kinesiology tape.
Stickier, stretchier,
and superior to competing tapes. Rock Tape stays on through any activity
for up to 7 days.
Physical therapists qualify for medical pricing. Get started at rocktape.com/start. Rock Tape also offers CEUs nationwide, so you can learn how to use the world's best tape
with cutting-edge, evidence-informed techniques
while earning the continuing education credits you need.
Get started at rocktape.com.
Considering a travel assignment over the holidays, or ready to escape the cold weather for some winter sunshine? Arias Medical Group is the leading healthcare staffing agency, offering travel and full-time career opportunities for PTs nationwide. Call Arias at 1-800-340-2619 or visit ariusmedical.com. That's ariusmedical.com.
Working at his orbicularis oris until failure. Jimmy McKay on the PT Pinecast.
All right, we're back in the PT Pinecast. with John Childs. Want to make sure you guys can get in touch with this guy. Evidenceinmotion.com is the website. You can follow him on Twitter at ChildsJD. Three questions sponsored by our partners, Arias Medical Staffing. First up, I'm sure you lived all over the place. Pittsburgh, Air Force Academy. Where's someplace you wouldn't mind hanging up your hat for a little while and hanging out?
Well, if you could get paid in Colorado, I'd love to be back in Colorado. I love my experience at Colorado Springs. You pay a huge sort of lifestyle tax as a PT in Colorado, as you might imagine.
Is the income lower for
well,
a PT?
Well, the payments, tough in Colorado. And, of course, everybody and their brother wants to live in Colorado. So there's lots and lots of therapists that want jobs in Colorado.
Well, I was hanging out with a guy we've had on the show before, James Spencer, who's a travel PT and been doing so for about a decade. And he would spend 6 months somewhere and 6 months in Aspen. It would always be 6 months in Hawaii, 6 months in Aspen, 6 months on the Cape, 6 months in Aspen. So I was like, you got to figure it out. He's like, yeah, kind of. But he's like, he said, it's not easy to do, especially in Colorado, because everybody wants to come there.
No, that's right.
Second question, what's something that you're either currently reading or recently read that inspired you that you would say, yeah, to a colleague, you need to read this?
You know, it's interesting. I have shifted a lot of my attention away from reading books from sort of cover to cover to really digesting. I do a lot of audio, a lot of podcasts. I scan a lot of the sort of the literature. I think a lot of the leadership stuff that's done, you know, the Jim Collins, the Good to Great, some of the classics. I think, you know, part of the problem with the book industry, as you might imagine, is it's just littered with tons of stuff. So I like to kind of, when I get overwhelmed with all the contemporary stuff, sort of go back, go old school and kind of go back in time.
I had like a weird thing where I wanted to, for like a year, I wanted to read all those books that people talked about at cocktail parties. So I read like Catcher in the Rye and One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest and Catch 22, and I was like, these are really great books. And I was like, okay, but I could have read, you know, the bestseller from this month. But I was like, I think I got a lot out of it, and I got something to talk about at a cocktail party. I can sell some. I'm like, well, that's a Catch 22, and I know what that means because I read the book. So I can do one of those.
Yeah, books. And I have to say, I've become a little bit disenfranchised with you look at the backgrounds a lot of the authors who write these books, and nothing wrong with folks being, you know, in the media or being a press journalist. There's nothing wrong with that at all. But then they'll write sort of these how-to books about how to do business.
But they're not.
And
a
you
business
sort of look
person,
at their
right?
own backgrounds, yeah. And you're kind of like, so what have you ever done.
Right.
It's the same thing with a lot of consultants, frankly, in the physical therapy industry of folks and who, when you look at their backgrounds, they've ultimately not actually done the very things that they're telling everyone that
how
you should
do.
Be doing. So
yeah.
The older I get, the more narrow my set of sort of potential mentors and those that I'm
that's
sort
good.
Of willing to listen to
I think
becomes.
I think that's a good way to put it, because as a student, I remember I would just, who am I going to pay attention to? It's kind of like, I kind of relate this podcast to a bar where it's just me walking around and bumping into people and having good conversations like we're doing. But sometimes that can be dangerous because sometimes the loudest guy in the room who's talking the most isn't the guy you should be following.
No,
he's the last guy you should be following.
No, and I say this all the time, and I'm a huge fan of social media, so don't get me wrong, and we certainly use it a lot on the EIM side. I use it personally. But folks that have some of the biggest profiles in social media, they're spending so much time in social media. Like, what are they actually doing?
They're real good at social media.
The kinds of folks that, in my mind, that you really want to be mentored and learned by are probably faces and names you probably don't know who they are
right.
because they're so busy actually doing.
Radio segue. Third question is, who's someone in the field of physical therapy that we should know more about but we don't? Who's somebody who's flying under the radar that we should pay attention to but who isn't barking on social media?
Let's see. I think of industry leaders. I think of people like Mark Kaufman, for example, who's the CEO at Athletico. Now he's got a larger social media profile now, but has grown a tremendous organization, and yet you ask a lot of folks around in the profession, don't know who he is because he's not out there sort of trumpeting himself.
He's doing.
He's doing. And, you know, I have to consider myself, I've been incredibly blessed, you know, so I've grown up in sort of two worlds. In an academic world, I've had a very traditional academic background, PhD, like I said, working with folks like, you know, Tony DeLito and Julie Fritz and really some of the, what I thought and are some of the brightest minds. And then on the business side, I've had the opportunity to obviously partner with folks like Larry Benz on the practice side and a whole team of folks, Bridget Finley and Rob Wehner and Tim Flynn, and just a whole cast of characters that really bridge both sides of the gap. You know, part of the, I don't want to say problem in physical therapy is you look at our professional association and it's a lot of the leadership comes from academics. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but they don't always cross over on the business and the
right.
practice side. And so I consider myself really, really fortunate. I wouldn't say it was by design, but I ended up being able to sort of benefit from both sides. And that's really what has come to be at Evidence in Motion.
And that's one thing that I took away. It's similar, is I can say it because I stood up in Graham Sessions and said it, after an exercise that we had performed in a session, I noticed that we were really, really good at explaining what we did to each other, but not really, really good at explaining what we do to the people who need our services. So where I think we need to bring in people from different avenues, business, outside of academia, communications. For me, obviously, I'm gonna blow that horn because it's my thing. That's somewhere, I mean, look at this room. This room is huge. 14,000. We're setting a record at this CSM. Physical therapists showing up. We've got a profession who cares. How do we make the people who need us know that they need us? We need to communicate. So we need to look, you know, outside or look at the weirdos, and I'm using air quotes, in PT. Someone who has a, you know, somebody who's been in the Air Force. You know, why would you do that? Well, that's going to give you some stuff. You're going to be able to transfer over. What'd you take from the Air Force and the business background that you're able to transfer over that you'd say to a youngin', a student right now, here's what I got out of this?
I tell people all the time, you know, I grew up in small town Alabama. I was kind of a mama's boy growing up. And when I went to the Air Force Academy, I became a colloquialism, but I became a man. And, you know, what I learned in the military was, you know, I think the discipline, it's the hard work. You know, you don't get somewhere easy. One of the biggest things I see with young students is they look at people, you know, like myself or others who, you know, they think have achieved something, and they want to think that they can sort of just Twitter their way to success just by being sort of known.
Right.
And it's much more than that. You know, you put in really super long days and hard hours, and, you know, talk to my wife and stuff when I was in my PhD program, you know, being in class till 10, 11 o'clock at night and doing this thing 6-7 days a week for 3 years. I mean, you know, you have to make very deep investments, and you've got to have a supportive family, and it's a lot harder than what it may look like on the outside.
Sure, yeah. If it looks really, really easy, chances are a lot of work went into it to make it look that smooth.
No, that's right.
We talked a little bit, we dabbled with it, but what's your prediction? The stuff you're doing with South College. I heard you talk in different facets, listen to the podcast, and kind of, you guys get into it. Are we going to make the change? Is that going to happen? Is academia going to embrace this? Or are they going to kind of stay kind of entrenched and we shouldn't change in terms of DPT education and how it's set up?
Yeah, so I'll try to put a little bit of a crystal ball on. So a couple of things. Number one, the good news is we have an enormous applicant pool. Lots of folks that want to become therapists.
I know. I was nervous. I would never get in.
Yeah, 6 or 7 applicants for every seat. So the reality is, if you talk to a lot of quote-unquote traditional academics, they would tell you that we really don't have a problem in DPT education because we've got lots of applicants. Students are graduating, getting licensed, and they're getting jobs. So, hey, what's wrong? Even if clinical education is kind of broken, who cares? You know, it's working good enough. On the EIM side, we take the position, though, that DPT education has gotten too long, too expensive, and we're about to perhaps hit a bubble of sorts where we're losing our best applicants to other professions.
Can't blame them.
And we want to be on the leading edge of that and helping to shorten, optimize, improve the quality. You know, we don't apologize for a 2-year model. I mean, this is not about churning out some robot technician kinds of therapist that barely passes the board.
Right.
We actually believe that we can develop a more professionalized, higher quality therapist at better value. And we're seeing that in our first class. One of the real common, I shouldn't say criticisms, but it came up in the Graham sessions, was how do you professionalize your students over a 2-year period of time? Is that really enough time to kind of become indoctrinated into the profession and what it really means to be a professional? And our sort of, at least short term response to that is, if you look at our first class, we've got about 70 to 75% of our graduates who are going to be going on to residency training in year 3. There's no other DPT program in the country that has more than 5% of their graduates going into residency training. And so we think that the fact that our students are voluntarily electing to go into residency training to continue their education, voluntary, don't have to, they could go get a job anywhere, is strong evidence that our students are becoming professionalized at a very rapid pace.
In 2 years versus
because
three.
Their expectation as a student is what you do when you graduate is you go on to residency training. And so we think that's a real strength of what we're seeing, at least in this early stage.
We've talked about it before on the show. Do you think it'll ever get to a point where residencies are the standard? I mean, just mathematically, there's not enough right now to have every guy and girl go to be a residency. Will we get to that?
I hope we do. As long as DPT stays at 3 years, $120,000, it's not going to happen.
Can't do it.
I counsel lots and lots of students, and most of the students, I frankly encourage them not to go into residency training because they can't afford it.
Yeah.
So there's very few students who can afford it. There's not enough residency opportunities that are out there. I've said this before, and I genuinely mean it. We are not proud of the fact at EIM that we're the largest residency provider by a factor of 10. That's not a compliment to me. We need more residency programs.
Right.
We need more slots. We need the residency programs that are out there to scale up and offer more opportunity. We hope as part of our value add to the profession and the ecosystem of physical therapy, if you will, that we can come alongside others that want to start residency programs and assist them in doing that.
Here's how you do it.
And so we're very happy to sort of share ideas, to partner, to work with folks. So I think that's part of it is supply demand. We need more residency slots, but we've got to get a handle on DPT education from a length and from a cost.
Okay.
And, you know, if we have our way with it over time, you know, hopefully we'll be able to scale up enough of these kind of two-year blended models that the applicant pool will demand more value,
right,
and that they will shift towards a two-year model. That'll encourage programs to innovate, to change, to think about cutting a semester off here, cutting a course off here, lowering tuition here, and we think that'll be sort of the trend going forward.
I like it. Bringing those two things together, we talked about evidence-based practice coming about and coming of age and DPT education. You guys are going to graduate your first class, and now people will be able to say, did it work or did it not work? It's going to take some time because people will look back and, you know, hindsight's 20/20, but they'll say, they're doing it, it's working, and it's working well. So now we should shift. So it's almost like you're going to be, I mean, you guys are the guinea pigs. You're going to be the people churning it out first. And time is going to say, well, if it's working, we better jump on that or we're going to be a dinosaur.
And what's really fascinating, and I'm smiling as I'm listening to you make these comments, you know, it took us 2 years to find our first partner. I mean, we got told no by a lot of institutions, schools.
South College,
because it's a different enough model, disruptive enough that people go, you're going to do what?
And they're going to put their name on it. They
exactly.
have to trust you.
And so South took a chance with us, and we obviously deeply value that relationship. But now that it's working, what's interesting is not many folks want to lead and be first, but there are a lot of people who say, wow, this actually seems to be working. Maybe we want to do that same thing.
Right.
So we're in development now with Baylor University, for example, to build a similar two-year accelerated model in Dallas and other institutions that we're starting to talk to and work with. So we're starting to see the tide shift where what used to be this sort of violent opposition is starting to become kind of watchful waiting.
People kind of circling and saying, is this working?
Yeah, and what we know will be true is, and hopefully this will happen sooner rather than later, is 5 years from now, a lot of other people will be doing similar kinds of things, and it'll be everybody else's idea. And when it becomes everybody else's idea, we will know in our own minds that this has been a real success. And so we look forward to that time when we can see other people trying new, harebrained, crazy ideas. Maybe some like us, and maybe in different ways. We hope it inspires other people to do innovative things in education.
Cool. I like it. All right. You can find out more, evidenceinmotion.com, at ChildsJD on Twitter, and also on iTunes, and the podcast out there, Evidence in Motion. You can take a listen to that. Pleasure talking to you. I know as podcasters, we can go on for hours and hours and hours, but we're at CSM. We got stuff to do. We got free stuff to go around and collect. But appreciate you taking out some time. I really hope this isn't the last time we talk, because, as you said, we can get down some rabbit holes and really get into some stuff, and I hope we do at a later date. But definitely appreciate you taking some time out here at CSM.
You bet, Jimmy. Thanks for having me.
The biggest name in physical therapy podcasts is now doing the news. PT Pinecast host Jimmy McKay covers the news in physical therapy in 15 minutes or less, or your money back.
Wait, you're not actually making people pay, right? Oh, we're still on?
Spinal Tap News. You don't have time to search for what's news in PT, and that's where we come in. From the brewers of the PT Pinecast, it's Spinal Tap News. PT News, pint-sized.
The PT Pinecast is a product of PT Pinecast, LLC.
It is hosted and produced by PT Pinecast CEO, Jimmy McKay,
with executive producer Rachel German from the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee.
And CBO, Sky Donovan from Marymount University.
We talk PT, drink beer, and record it.
This has been another pour from the PT Pinecast.
The PT Pinecast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. Our lawyers made us read that.